Welcome to 4.0 to Pro, the pickleball podcast that focuses on a single shot, tip, or strategy to improve your pickleball game with every single pocket-sized episode. Our goal is to make you better on the court every time you hear our voices. And now your hosts, 4.something Michael O'Neill, and USA Pickleball National Silver Medalist, Senior Pro Scott Fliegelman.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of 4.0 to Pro, your pocket-sized pickleball podcast, where we teach you a single shot or strategy every single episode. I'm Michael O'Neill here in rainy Long Beach, California, joined by my good pal, Mr. Scott Fliegelman there in Boulder, Colorado. Hello, Scott.
I am back from our Florida trip. It's lovely here in Boulder. Got back at 1:30 in the morning. So I'm just getting going, but heading into Boulder Pickleball later today. And you know what? I'm going to get on the ball machine. I've been missing that. I need to get back and groove a few things before our open play session this evening.
I think there's something to throwing some headphones on and getting on the ball machine and just kind of doing your thing for an hour. It's very meditative. I can feel the same way on a wall. I mean, it's been super rainy here over the last few days. We've had a very rainy winter, but I think I'm going to get into one of the racquetball courts at my local club and just put my headphones on and work on some stuff while I'm meditating via pickleball.
Take what Mother Nature gives you. Go for it.
So, couple quick housekeeping things. Number one, as always, if you're looking for a carbon paddle, that's CRBN, you get 10% off at checkout by using the promo code 402P. And I'm just about, Scott, to order some of their soft goods. They've got some really cool shorts and they've got hoodies. And of course, their glasses, the Pivot glasses that we've talked about on the show a few weeks ago, are pretty awesome. And I know you are never on the court without them. The other thing I'm going to just tease really quickly, you guys, is that we've been adopted by Spotify. So in the very near future, you will hear some pre-roll and potentially mid-roll ads on the podcast, which is good, actually, because it helps us do this show for you guys and keep it going. So that's just coming down the road. Scott, on today's episode, we have part two of our AB episode. If you guys haven't heard the last show, go back and listen to the last show first, where we break down, as you are playing through a game scenario, what your choices are on the court. And we've tried our best to break the choices down into an A choice or a B choice. We've pretty much covered serving. And on today's show, we're going to cover not only the return game, but a few different scenarios that we might find ourselves in. And then after that, we have a little bit of a bonus conversation that we got a bit of a bone to pick with some people in the pickleball community. And we're going to talk about it a little bit. So Scott, we are now the returners of serve. And weirdly, as we discussed before we started recording today, there's a lot of stuff we have to take into account as returners. But once we break it down a little bit, we go, man, we're making quite a few decisions, sometimes before the ball is even served. So why don't we sort of go through in order with our AB serve returns? Let's first assume, Scott, that we're returning and we don't have a plan. Why don't you take it from there?
One thing we mentioned on our last show was when we observe professional pickleball, it just looks like they see the game in slow motion. They always seem to make the right choice. And part of the struggle for lower rated players is that frequently they're running through 8, 9, 10 different options, or it certainly appears that way. And we're encouraging you guys during this show and the previous show to boil that down to either just one shot selection. My favorite one is when you're stuck in the mid-court transition area and the ball bounces, let's just go cross court with a cornhole style reset and let's just work on that so the execution can be really good. No shot selection quandary there at all. In other parts of the game, we have to make some decisions, but I'd love to boil it down to one or two. So absent of any pre-game discussion with my partner about where we're going to hit our returns, high, deep, and down the middle is our A. That's our best choice. Preferably, we've got some pre-serve alignment and visualization goals. We've chatted with each other about what we're going to do in this game in order to win. And now we've got an AB on our hands again. We've got, are we going to return to Bob or Frank? Which one of these guys are we going to return to? And now we can have ourselves a conversation, which you and I could do right now.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. Sometimes you get in trouble because they have a guy on their side that has a killer drive, and it's giving you a ton of trouble for shake and bakes. You're trying to target this weaker player as the returner. So you're going back to one player or the other, but the other one is so fast and spry and athletic. Their partner hits a drive, and then they're putting that shake and bake away like there's no tomorrow. So what your advice was, well, hit it to the guy that keeps pinning you on the shake and bake, and you're basically disabling their ability to get in there and disrupt and cause chaos. And I thought, what an interesting idea that I never would have really thought of, but it makes tons of sense. In lieu of that, I might try to go to that backhand corner for the left side player. Can you talk a little more about maybe some scenarios that you've been in that you've had to do something like that, where you're just getting pounded by some super athletic Ben Newell kind of guy that keeps making you pay for a shake and bake?
Yeah, that's a really good example in Ben, who I would assume in most partnering scenarios is going to be the striker, the pouncer. He's the player I'm more worried about on the fifth. And if we can return deep to Ben, we give ourselves a decent chance of keeping him out of the midcourt for one more shot, and we'll take our chances with his partner. But circling back to the A or B, when it comes to which one of these two players do we want to return to, if one of them has a glaringly weaker third shot, whether it's a drive or a drop, then there could be a compelling reason to return to that player. Frequently, that's not the case. They're both about the same. And that's where we get to the other discussion of which one of these players are we more concerned with on the fifth shot? And I'm making a pretty strong case that if we can return deep and impactfully to that player, we can keep them out of the midcourt for one more shot and take our chances with their partner, who's just not quite as intimidating when it comes to the fifth.
Well, I think where this really pops up, Scott, is in mixed, because our default might be, well, I'm going to return to the woman. That might not be the best plan, because now you're leaving the guy, some 6'4 dude who moves like a panther and is able to crush. This woman has an amazing third shot drive, and he's just giving you all kinds of trouble because he's just prowling on that fifth shot. Maybe you return to him, and now she's the one that has to try to make something happen on that fifth, and that might give you a little more of an advantage in that certain situation. So it makes tons of sense when you say it out loud, but when you're on the court, it's one of the things that I was like, man, that is really strange. But of course, that is the way you do it. This is exactly what you're supposed to do in this case.
Let me shine the light back in my direction. She's retired, so we're probably not playing much together anymore. But Eva Welsher and I had a very successful season last year in the inaugural NPL. And I was blown away how many of our really good opponents kept returning to her. And Eva's got a fantastic third shot drop. And while I'm not 6'4", nor a panther, I am pretty good on the prowl in the middle of the court. And they just kept returning to her. And thanks for the compliment, guys, but my third shot drive is not that good, right, that you have to keep the ball away from me. Just using us as an example, if you were playing against me and a top female senior pro, I'd probably return to me and take your chances with my partner on the fifth. I mean, what am I going to do? Given a few things away to my NPL competitors this year.
So another layer of complexity in this return is whether you should hit a slice or a topspin return. So there's another AB, Scott, on top of where it's going to go. It's, well, how am I going to hit this ball? Traditionally, we've suggested, I mean, for years now, it's been suggested that a nice balanced slice is typically, that's an undercut, that's a backspin type return, has been the way to go. Although there's a mentality now that says, well, if you slice the ball, you may be giving your opponents topspin on that next shot, which is true. And I'm curious if you could break down when you might slice versus when you might topspin a ball and what scenarios those are.
There are a couple of different scenarios. I'll try to keep it simple. If I'm playing singles, I have gravitated away from the slice return because that provides my opponent the pre-spin in order to hit some wicked topspin. The ball's rotating in the direction of their topspin thanks to my slice, and it makes their passing shot that much more potent. So in singles, I'm going to be looking for topspin, which also accentuates my aggressiveness in trying to get the ball deep with that helping hand of topspin that helps that ball dive so I can go for the baseline and prioritize the deep return. Another AB for deciding topspin or slice is if the ball is to my forehand, I tend to feel more comfortable rolling over that ball and hitting topspin. And if it comes to my backhand, courtesy of my tennis background, I'm really comfortable with a slice. I will give the advice, and I do that with my students, and we've shared this a little bit on the show, that if you're playing 3.5 to 4.3, your opponents may still be heavily impacted by your slice return, meaning they can't quite figure out the physics, the quandary of the situation, and they dump that ball into the middle of the net. If that's the case, keep slicing. But once we get above 4-4, 4-5, those opponents generally are able to counteract your slice, raise their target, and then if they're applying topspin, that ball's really going to have a lot of shape to it. So I'm factoring all of those things in play sequentially, some of this before the rally starts, and then others as the rally starts to play out.
Often, Scott, if you're playing right side and somebody serves to the tee, so they're serving to your backhand, but it's a pretty potent serve and maybe a little more difficult to get a one-handed cradle slice on the ball, how often will you hit a two-y topspin backhand at that point?
I find that it's mostly the depth of the serve. If they're able to really get that ball on me, which I'm before the return, starting as far back as possible, but occasionally right, they can get that ball in on me, that's when I tend to leave that second hand on. I don't feel as comfortable. That ball gets on me and the slice doesn't feel right, but a two-handed blocking return with two hands when that ball is super deep, that's what I would say.
Yeah, like a little flatter. It's not like a super high topspin ball. I was thinking the same thing.
Correct.
And then scenario three, Scott, is unwinding the stack. So you are stacking with a partner. And in this case, we go back to kind of the trick question from the first episode on this. There's no B. There's only returning down the line with some loft on it to give enough time to make it to the non-volley zone. I think where we can get in trouble is if we're somewhat new to the stack and we return back to that player who just served us. So a cross-court ball, and then we've got a huck it. Let's say we're playing the right side. Our right side all the way to the left side non-volley zone, which is a long diagonal, long in terms of pickleball, giving the opponent a huge lane to rip the ball down the line. So what we recommend is return down the line, return right in front of you so that your teammate can step in front of that drive. And if your opponents want to hit a ball to that space, well, they got to go cross court. It's going to take a little longer to get there. And hopefully by then you've established yourself, you've done a split step and you're waiting for that block.
Fully agree. There's really no great B in this case. And you mentioned, we do this all the time on the show, relatively high return. And how high? How fast do you feel like running? Some of us with some good wheels can afford to drive it down the line and then just make it to the spot. But the worst thing we can do here is drive it cross court and not be all that fleet of foot. And you've just opened up a rather easy down the line passing shot and your partner can't help you much with it.
All right. So that's returning. Now we are, let's say, established at the non-volley zone. Scott, we're ready. We've got our wall ready. Why don't you take what happens when someone fires a drive at us?
Well, I think it does play rather nicely into our AB. And I'm mostly interested in blocking that ball back at their feet, wherever the heck their feet are. Probably the player who just hit the previous shot, they haven't gotten all that far in, and I'm going to try and get that ball back at their feet. And so that's my A. That's where I'm going most of the time. I tend to move to an option B when I'm playing against really good bangers. I probably need even a different word for that, a good power team that likes to get the ball out of the air and stay on the gas. In this case, I am willing to invite them in. I'm willing to drop the ball, not necessarily as a clean winner, but at least get them scurrying forward to try to scoop that ball And we've coaxed them into a four-person ritual kitchen exchange, which may be to our advantage and not the style of play they're looking for. So that's what I'm going to move to be. I really want to make that ball bounce, and I'll go with more of absorbing the energy of their drive and dropping the ball at their feet. And otherwise, my plan A is just get my feet under me, block the ball back to their feet, wherever the heck their feet are.
Yeah, because that's way counter to what pickleball was when I got into it now 3 years ago. I guess almost 4 years ago now. You always kept them back. That was always the way to go. But I think because of paddle technology, because people are just getting better, they're getting way more topspin on the ball. They're able to hit the ball way harder than they were back then. It makes sense. Is that a conversation you would have with a partner? Would you say something like, hey, we're getting eaten up in the transition zone. These guys are jumping on our volleys and railing it back at us. Let's lure them in. Let's just both try to drop and just do a nice short ball, make them kind of scurry to get it so we can maybe try to get some strategy around a dink rally. Is that what you're saying?
I would do that for sure. And I love the use of first person plural. If you guys, you know, haven't been listening to the show long, we do frequently talk about in partner communication, let's try to refrain from, hey, how about if you do a better job of playing pickleball? No, if you drop that ball, let's use first person plural. Hey, how about if we identify that trying to keep them back with our fourth shot is just giving them a knee-high drive, which is exactly what they want. Why don't we take our chances with dropping that ball, inviting them in, and luring them into a molasses slow kitchen exchange, which is very clear is not their preferred style of play.
I used to do that with a singles guy that I played. He was so good. He would get everything that I hit on the court. And finally, I said, he's not good at the net at all. So I'm going to start. I literally started dropping in singles just to get him to the net. And I would start winning those points because it just wasn't his strong suit. He wasn't a very good dinker or volleyer. But man, could he bang the heck out of it from the baseline or even like halfway through the transition zone. But it was a very effective strategy in that respect. Okay, so now we're at the four-person ritual kitchen exchange. We are dinking with this crew. And our two options are, Scott, to let it bounce and to get it out of the air. So A is to let it bounce. And we may step back. That thing might be perfectly at our feet at the non-volley zone line. I was just drilling with a buddy of mine the other day, and his tendency was to really short hop those dinks, the ones that were right by his feet. And I said, just for fun, why don't you decide to take a step back there, have a pivot foot like basketball. He's a righty. Keep your right foot planted and take a big step back with your left foot and just give yourself a little more time to hit the ball. Because what was happening, Scott, is that his short hop, half volley dinks weren't very controlled. They were sort of popping up and going all over the place. I said, just give yourself just a millisecond more time. Extend that arm back and take a nice step back. And all of a sudden, his dinks became slow and rhythmic and much more controlled. So A is let it bounce. B, and especially if you've got length and reach, get it out of the air. And if you can get it out of the air, you do something that to me becomes one of the most critical assets of a 4-5 plus player, which is reducing the amount of time your opponents have to react to the ball. They're not ready yet. They're not fully split step. Maybe they're not balanced. If you're able to take a dink out of the air, it's coming back on them quicker than they expect it to, which is going to give you an advantage. Maybe you get him in the shoulder. Maybe you get him out of time, out of sync, and you may end up being able to speed it up or do something with that ball. But it does disrupt the flow of their rhythm, which would be a really great reason to take it out of the air.
I love every way that you express that. If I were to add anything, I would just say that I tend to prioritize getting balls out of the air only if I am on balance. I'm going to be looking to split step when the ball's on my opponent's paddle. I'm going to use my best squatting and lunging technique, keep my shoulders level with the net tape. And if I feel like I can minimize the hinging in my waist, let most of the hinging be done at my knees, then I'm prepared to get a ball out of the air and then get all the benefits that you just described so well, stealing time, stealing rhythm, stealing comfort. I can dink back out of the air. I don't have to do anything fancy. But if I'm on balance, I could choose to instigate. I could choose to lob. I could choose to dink intentionally. I just like to prioritize getting balls out of the air. And frequently, I will remind myself in between rallies, especially if they're out dinking me, oh, yeah, why don't I just get more of these out of the air? And then all the advice that you gave about if and when you choose to let it bounce, I totally subscribe to.
One of the first times we ever drilled together, it was actually my first lesson with you. You said you may be 5'8", but play 6'4". And that always stuck with me. And part of the technical side of that was, if you guys stand in the non-volley zone, you reach out as far as you can, have someone there and have them put their hand right where your paddle was, extended towards the net, and then squat down a little bit and hang your free hand behind your body for a counterbalance and reach out even more. And I promise you, you're going to go 4 or 5 inches longer into the non-volley zone. And you're actually going to be able to take more balls that way, being a little bit lower, a little more stretched out, and a little more balanced, like Scott just said. And you'll find that you can play a little more 6'4"-y than whatever your actual height is. I think it's a really cool idea.
And even more than just the offhand, and Simone Jargim comes to mind, and Paris Todd, and the two of them have played together, is by counterbalancing with your leg. You can really get balls out of the air because you've got a heavier counterbalance behind you. That takes a little bit of work, but they're clearly prioritizing getting balls out of the air and just using the best mechanical techniques they can in order to do so without ending up in the kitchen. So now that we're hopefully prioritizing, at least for me, plan A, which is getting more balls out of the air, it gives us the comfort to be able to then decide contextually, does this rally benefit me to go ahead and speed up? And I offer a couple of terms to clarify speed ups. Balls that are above net level, I look at as attackable balls. And these are balls that I want us to hit hard into the open space, primarily down the middle. But when we've got a ball that is below net level, especially if we've decided that our dinking game doesn't necessarily match up with our opponents, we may need to bring the fight to them. They're not giving us pop-ups. We're going to have to coax one from them. Now I may choose, let's call that option B, to instigate, stir the pot, cause some trouble, coax a pop-up by getting the ball on the player directly in front of us, give or take 20% faster than they expect, with the goal of a two-shot combo, not of hitting a clean winner. That's frequently done by going at the playing hand shoulder to get things started. That's a chicken wing. It's really difficult to cover that spot. And as they begin to make adjustments on their end, we'll adjust on ours. And now we're playing some chess. And again, the whole goal is to instigate a pop-up, and or if the ball is already above net level, we can go right ahead and attack into the open space.
I don't know what the numbers are specifically, Scott, but I know over the last 2 or 3 years that the team that instigates wins more points than the team that doesn't, than the one that's just on pure defense. And maybe it's because, almost like an offense in football, they have the advantage of knowing where the ball's going to be. So they know they're going to go towards a specific shoulder. And sometimes if you know your opponents well, I describe somebody that I had played with, and I know that if I go to his left shoulder, and we're both on the same side, I'm on the right side, he's on the left side across from me, he goes cross court 99.9% of the time. So I can tell my partner, just be ready for a forehand in the middle, because it's coming right to your paddle. So I know that if we're in a dink rally and I speed up to that shoulder, we're probably winning that point. It becomes sort of this balance between your actual skill level. We talk about lowering the X and being able to instigate from however low to the ground the ball is, to that fine line between I'm hitting it into the net or popping it up a little bit high because I tried to instigate a ball that's a little too low for my current skill set, which is why we all work on the roles and the things we do. But in general, I think you'll find that controlled instigation will probably win more points than to sit back and be defensive most of the time, which again was probably pickleball 5 years ago.
And as I've shared with you guys a lot recently, that decision is not made in a vacuum. It's made with a healthy assessment of our strengths and weaknesses versus their strengths and weaknesses. And if we've decided we're just better dinkers than those guys, then yeah, playing 5-year-old school pickleball is maybe the better way to go. And if we've decided they're better dinkers than us and probably better across the board, then we need to bring the fight to them.
Agreed. This last scenario, Scott, is something that is one of those things that isn't talked about a ton in the pickleball world, and that is returning a lob. Those of us who came from tennis know that when that ball's in the air, we're extending our arm towards the ball. The paddle is scratching our back, so our elbow is typically very high. We're moving in a sidestep, balanced, shoulder width apart, sideways. So we're tracking it back, and we're going to try to get the ball out of the air. That is A. Hitting an overhead smash is A 100% of the time if we can do it. Pickleballs don't bounce very well. So even if they go 30 feet high, they're bouncing like a foot. The only B we have at that point is to try to drop it into the kitchen. If your name happens to be Daniel De La Rosa and you can turn around and fire a drive blindside and split the goalposts on your team, then hey, you do you, boo. But generally, the B is going to be a drop, because at that point, you're really just trying to survive. Both of the opponents are sitting at the non-volley zone waiting for you to do something.
I don't have too much to add to that. I think that's, you know, you and I come from similar schools for many years, including on court together. I'm going to say options A, B, C, D, and E are get that ball out of the air and hit an overhead smash. And then from there, if the ball got over our head, usually the player who can run back for it on the diagonal has the best angle to play the ball. And their number one option on their way back should be, I'm just going to drop this ball anywhere in the 7x20 foot safe space, the non-volley zone on the other side. If I'm under such duress that I can barely get to the ball, and all I can do is chuck it up in the air, I suppose I'm all right with an option C.
Where do you stand, Scott? This is actually a bit of a reverse scenario and one we find ourselves in often. Somebody hits the lob, you and your teammate go back to fetch it, and you hit that overhead. Well, now the other team's at the baseline, and they're trying to lob you back out of it, and you keep pounding it at the baseline. First of all, love this for a drop shot. That's a really good time to hit a drop shot. They're pounding overheads at you. Do you have an AB there, or is it just trying to get a drop in?
No, it's a great question. And yes, A is our way out of this predicament is a ball that bounces in their kitchen. That right. would be great. But frequently we're withstanding this barrage and not all that composed. And we just fight off whatever overhead smash they've hit at us by launching it up in the air and just live for another shot. But our way out of the predicament is to get the ball to bounce in their kitchen.
It's a really hard one because it's coming with such velocity and in such a wacky spot. We actually probably should do a whole show on that scenario, because a lot of it has to do with body language and reading their paddle before they hit the ball, in terms of how you spring to fetch wherever that ball is going to go, unless they're just incredibly deceptive, which happens as well. So that, guys, is the AB episode. We have gone through most of the scenarios we could figure out. And Scott, you were just at the Diadem Pickleball Complex in Florida, where I was for the NPL tryouts a few weeks ago, and ran into something that we saw a lot of, because it's a lot of courts packed into a very small space. And this is something, for whatever reason, as we go through our pickleball journey, this is something that a lot of people never really learned, because it's not something that people typically teach on a pickleball court. You and I learned a lot of this stuff because we came from tennis, and etiquette in tennis is a pretty big deal. It's a fairly polite sport overall. Can you talk a bit about your experience and what you've seen on the rec courts? Because I don't think you've been on rec courts that haven't been separated by nets in quite some time.
That's true. We do boast 10-foot divider nets at Boulder Pickleball. So rarely do you hear ball on court. But let me first compliment the Diadem peeps, because the facility is lovely, super high ceilings and great parking. And I mean, whoever had the vision to take this theater and turn it into, I think, a 9-court pickleball complex, good for you. And it's popular. And even in South Florida, they need indoor pickleball. So I was thrilled to play there. I had a great time with Brian and Susie and Julie. And thank you guys for having me out there. But there are no divider nets per se. So as most of you frequently get the chance to play on courts like this, ball on court is frequent. It happens all the time. And I was disappointed. I'm going to say the level of play on my neighboring courts was pretty high. It was probably 4-0 plus. And so I'm looking in the direction of our listeners to do a better job representing the better players out there by making sure that your etiquette is appropriate as balls roll on court from one to the other.
So as far as I'm concerned, as a ball rolls onto your court, you pick it up, you look to the court it came from. So eye contact is number one. I will typically gesture like who's serving, and I will hold the ball in front of my face, hold my paddle like a lollipop, and I will backspin, hit it to them with control. It's not a lofty ball. I don't hit it up in the air. And God forbid, I do not just turn around and fire it back in the general direction of their court, or even worse, just whack it like a golf ball as it rolls on to my court. When people do that, I just watch the ball and I watch it go to the next court. I go, cool, now you've just disrupted somebody else's game because you don't know how to hit a ball back to me. So I'm with you. It's a very frustrating thing when people don't know how to just feed a ball back and make the eye contact and get the ball back to the proper court.
What you've just described is what I experienced. And I know you, and I can visualize the way you're holding the ball and your paddle, which is non-verbally expressing, we're all ready to get back to playing pickleball here, but I'm not willing to just randomly return the ball back to your court. I'm ready to help you guys resume your play. Which of you would like the ball? Probably the server could put their paddle up and say, I'm the server. Would you please return the ball to me? That's what's all happening there non-verbally, unless you actually can speak words back and forth. Who's serving? You're holding the ball and the paddle up is expressing.
One thing that happens, Scott, is that sometimes I'll be playing with somebody and we'll lose one of our balls. Somebody will hit a shanked ball and it'll go on to somebody else's court. They immediately yell ball. And meanwhile, the other group is in the middle of this amazing, intense point. Meanwhile, our ball's rolling behind their baseline and on the way to the corner, and someone from our court disrupts their play. To me, I would prefer that everybody just stops and waits until that point is over, unless it is clear and apparent there's going to be a danger of somebody stepping on the ball.
Yeah, I'm in total agreement with that. I'm going to make a decision. If the ball went off the side of my paddle onto the next court, and it's rolling harmlessly behind their baseline, and they may or may not even see it, I'm not going to decide for them that they need to replay their rally. I'll let them decide. But if my ball off my paddle is rolling toward the feet of one or more of their players, that's where I'm going to jump in for their safety and right, yell ball on court loudly enough to stop their rally. Even if it's a fabulous rally, I don't need one of them tripping on the ball. So same thing in reverse, a ball rolls onto our court. Hopefully they've given us the respect of letting us decide, especially if the ball is behind our play, to decide whether or not that ball on court is distracting to us. And that's how I prefer it to go. If the ball is not going to be in our way or distract us, we can go ahead and finish out that rally. But after the rally is over and you've dumped one into the net, is not the time, I'm encouraging you, not the time to say, well, actually, you guys, that ball rolled onto the court and I was kind of distracted. No, you've got one chance to yell ball and stop play, not trying to mid-rally factor whether or not you're up in the rally. And maybe we should just let that ball go. So I tend to, when I catch a ball out of my peripheral vision coming onto our court, yell ball on court, just so it doesn't necessarily end up under the feet of one of the players.
Well, for the last portion, Scott, of the get off my lawn portion of 4.0 to Pro, the last thing that I want to mention is stop walking onto courts, A, for your ball. If your ball rolls behind and I'm in the middle of a point and you walk behind me as I'm playing the point, that's going to irritate me. Or if you're heading to your court, wait till the point's over. That happened a lot at the Diadem. We were very respectful. There was a queue of people because the way the courts are set up, it's kind of interesting. You have to walk off the stage, and where you walk off is right next to court one, basically. And if you're on that court, it's fun because you're sort of center court, but the downside is literally everybody in the complex has to walk by you or through your court to get somewhere. And there's a lot of start and stop and pause, and it feels like you're at a bus station or something. So as you guys know, if you've got to go through somebody's court, just wait till the point's over. If your ball rolls over to their court, if it's not dangerous, just wait till the point's over. Don't go in the middle of the point because it is very distracting. And sometimes you're hitting your best ESPN Sports Center shot. And now this person just ruined your top 10 chance. So there you go.
As I'm sure you guys are already doing, make sure you get your entire group together before you go ahead and disrupt the neighboring court. Get all four of you, get everybody ready to go, get your gear, and rally ends. Okay, you guys, let's go. And let's get through that court and minimize the imposition you're causing on that neighboring court.
I was in one of those courts for a tournament that was the door on the way to the other three courts. Oh, yeah. It could not have been more distracting and getting me. I had to end up putting headphones on. I put headphones on just to try to keep focused. And I'm already not focused on a pickleball court. Anyway, guys, that is the AB episode. I hope you found this lovely and entertaining and helpful. So as always, go out and have some fun on the pickleball court. Scott, thank you very much. Go enjoy your ball machine later today.
Thank you, Michael.
And we will see you guys next time.
Thank you for listening to 4.0 to Pro. For more tips, find us on Instagram at 4.0 to Pro. If you have a pickleball question, submit it at picklehelp.com. Now, get out there and dominate. But don't forget to have fun.